Chapter 29, A Common Experience. Finally, the day came when I had written down everything I could, every last memory of the realm of the Earthworm's Eye View, the Gateway, and the Core. Then it was time to read. I plunged into the ocean of NDE literature, an ocean into which I'd never so much as dipped a toe before. It didn't take me long to realize that countless other people had experienced the things I had, both in recent years and centuries past. NDEs are not all the same. Each one is unique, but the same elements show up again and again, and many I recognize from my own experience. Narratives of passing through a dark tunnel or valley into a bright and vivid landscape, ultra-real, were as old as ancient Greece and Egypt. Angelic beings, sometimes winged, sometimes not, went back at least to the ancient Near East, as did the belief that such beings were guardians who watched the activities of people on Earth and greeted those people when they left it behind. The sense of being able to see in all directions simultaneously, the sensation of being above linear time, of being above everything, essentially, that I had previously thought of as defining the landscape of human life, the hearing of anthem-like music which entered through one's whole being rather than simply one's ears, the direct and instantaneous reception of concepts that normally would have taken a very long time and a great deal of study to comprehend without any struggle whatsoever. Feeling the intensity of unconditional love. Over and over in the modern NDE accounts and in spiritual writings from earlier times, I'd feel the narrator struggling with the limitations of earthly language, trying to get the entirety of the fish they had hooked on board the boat of human language and ideas, and always, to one degree or another, failing. And yet, with each attempt that fell frustratingly short of its goal, each person straining at language and ideas to get this enormity across to the reader, I'd understand the aim of the storyteller and what they'd hoped to convey in all of its boundaryless majesty, but simply couldn't. Yes, 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 I'd say to myself as I read. I understand. These books, this material, had all, of course, been there before my experience, but I'd never looked at it, not just in terms of reading, but in another way as well. Quite simply, I'd never held myself open to the idea that there might be anything genuine to the idea that something of us survives the death of the body. I was the quintessential good-natured, albeit skeptical, doctor. And as such, I can tell you that most skeptics aren't really skeptics at all. To be truly skeptical, one must actually examine something and take it seriously. And I, like many doctors, had never taken the time to explore NDEs. I had simply known they were impossible. I also went through the medical records of my time in coma, a time that was meticulously recorded, practically from the very start. Reviewing my scans just as I would have for a patient of my own, it became clear to me at last just how fantastically sick I had been. Bacterial meningitis is unique among diseases in the manner in which it attacks the outer surface of the brain while leaving its deeper structures intact. The bacteria efficiently wreck the human part of our brain first and finally prove fatal by attacking the deeper housekeeping structures common to other animals deep beneath the human part. The other conditions that can damage the neocortex and cause unconsciousness, head trauma, stroke, brain hemorrhages or brain tumors, are not nearly as efficient at completely damaging the entire surface of the neocortex. These tend to involve only part of the neocortex, leaving other parts unscathed and able to function. Not only that, but instead of taking the neocortex alone out, they tend to also damage the deeper and more primitive parts of the brain as well. Given all of this, bacterial meningitis is arguably the best disease one could find if one were seeking to mimic human death without actually bringing it about. Though, of course, it usually does. The sad truth is that virtually everyone as sick as I was from bacterial meningitis never returns to tell the tale. Please refer to Appendix A. Though the experience is as old as history, the near-death experience, regardless of whether it was seen as something real or a baseless fantasy, only became a household term fairly recently. In the 1960s, new techniques were developed that allowed doctors to resuscitate patients who had suffered a cardiac arrest. Patients who in former times simply would have died were now pulled back into the land of the living. Unbeknownst to them, these physicians were, through their rescue efforts, producing a breed of trans-earthly voyagers, people who had glimpsed beyond the veil and returned to tell about it. Today, they number in the millions. Then, in 1975, a medical student named Raymond Moody published a book called Life After Life, in which he described the experience of a man named George Ritchie. Ritchie had died as a result of cardiac arrest, as a complication of pneumonia, and been out of his body for 9 minutes. He traveled down a tunnel, visited heavenly and hellish regions, met a being of light that he identified as Jesus, and experienced feelings of peace and well-being that were so intense he had difficulty putting them into words. The era of the modern near-death experience was born. I couldn't claim complete ignorance of Moody's book, but I had certainly never read it. I didn't need to, because I knew, first of all, that the idea that cardiac arrest represented some kind of close-to-death condition was nonsense. Much of the literature about near-death experiences concerns patients whose hearts stop for a few minutes, usually after an accident or on the operating table. The idea that cardiac arrest constitutes death is outdated by about 50 years. Many lay people still believe that if someone comes back from cardiac arrest, then they have died and returned to life. But the medical community long ago revised its definitions of death to center on the brain, not the heart. Ever since brain death criteria, which rely on crucial findings of the patient's neurological examination, were established in 1968. Cardiac arrest is relevant to death only in terms of its effect on the brain. Within seconds of cardiac arrest, cessation of blood flow to the brain leads to widespread disruption of cooperative neural activity and loss of consciousness. For half a century, surgeons have routinely stopped the heart for minutes to hours in cardiac surgery and occasionally neurosurgery, using cardiopulmonary bypass pumps, and sometimes cooling the brain to enhance its viability under such stresses. No brain death occurs. Even a person whose heart stops on the street might be spared brain damage, provided that someone starts performing cardiopulmonary resuscitation within 4 minutes and the heart can eventually be restarted. As long as oxygenated blood travels to the brain, and therefore the person, will stay alive, albeit transiently unconscious. This piece of knowledge was all I needed to discount Moody's book without ever opening it. But now I did open it, and reading the stories Moody reported with the reference of what I myself had gone through made me completely shift my perspective. I had little doubt that at least some of the people in these stories had genuinely left their physical bodies. The similarities with what I myself had experienced beyond the body were simply too overwhelming. The more primitive parts of my brain, the housekeeping parts, functioned for all or most of my time in coma. But when it came to the part of my brain that every single brain scientist will tell you is responsible for the human side of me, well, that part was gone. I could see it on the scans, in the lab numbers, on my neurological exams, and all the data from my very closely recorded week in hospital. I quickly began to realize that mine was a technically near-impeccable near-death experience, perhaps one of the most convincing such cases in modern history. What really mattered about my case was not what happened to me personally, but the sheer flat-out impossibility of arguing from a medical standpoint, that it was all fantasy. Describing what an NDE is challenging at best, but doing so in the face of a medical profession that refuses to believe it's possible at all makes it even harder. Due to my career in neuroscience and my own NDE, I now have the unique opportunity to make it more palatable.